This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. How often do you think about your soap? Well, if you answered, not much, maybe you should. You see, a lot of what passes for soap in stores is technically not soap, according to the FDA's definition. It's full of lab-created chemicals and detergents because, well, it's cheaper to make. Now, what if you could buy natural soap made from natural ingredients like tallow, palm oil, coconut oil, and scented with essential oils, and for just a little more than you'd pay for grocery store soap? Sterling soap is 100% natural, and with a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne, there's a product and a scent for just about everybody. Check them out for yourself at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
Looking for the perfect gift for that basketball fan in your life? Well, I've got a book for you. It's called Basketball Now. Newly updated for 2025, it spotlights 50 of the NBA's top stars. Think fast breaks, clutch threes, and buzzer beaters. Captured in stunning photography with sharp, readable analysis. From rising stars to veteran icons, this book is a courtside pass to the game right now. Wrap up a slam dunk this holiday season and pick up your copy of Basketball Now today at your favorite bookseller.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Sports History Network in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon. The one and only, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show today.
That Red Grange and Steve Largent bookend always just makes me smile.
Well, you have the best of both worlds. You have the vintage with the new.
Oh.
And you have a true mix of the history of the game.
By the way, I sent our football nerds text group a picture of a little find a card take a card, leave a card thing. You know,
right.
I don't know about where you live, but people put like little book stands up or they'll put books in.
Right.
Well, my daughter and I were walking the dogs the other day and I came across one with some baseball cards in it. So I sent a picture to our text group, named Football Nerds, and the captain threw a Hail Mary to me. And he's like, I better see some football in that in the next couple days.
I better.
When collected, some standard, Joe Squires, material. And daughter and I went out this morning to find it, and I couldn't find it.
Are you kidding me?
We walked about a mile and a half up these two streets where I thought it was. I'm like, did we walk by that to my daughter?
But wow. Do you think they take it down at night?
I just think I was, talking to her and we walked by it. It was on one of three streets. I couldn't remember. We did this big hike and we came down a different way. So, well, I'll try it again. But I had a little bag filled with the typical stuff, 89 Pacific Steve Largent wax pack, just something that'll really get the kids into collecting football.
I have my four packs back there. I'm thinking
there it is, sir.
Hermetically sealed by engraved PSA or some well-known grading company.
And, should have autographed that from the personal collection of Joe Squires.
Yeah. I put it mine. We need to put our pedigree on a lot of this stuff. So, I mean, it's important. Well, I'll tell you, Joe, I was in I just want to lead off a brief recap of the big bad National Sports Collectors Convention in beautiful downtown Rosemont, Illinois, seconds from O'Hare Airport via the hotel shuttle and the praying for life drive from the airport to the shuttle with traffic I haven't seen in a long time being down here. But anyways, it was a very interesting. I only spent 2 days at the actual convention. Thursday, I came in the afternoon and I got to the room early. I relaxed a little, and we had a problem at the house here, which was comical to say the least. I was almost a job for Squires Electric. Phone one of your guys over here and fix the thing. We had a lightning strike. Oh. And it blew out our outside GFI box where the cable box is. Oh. And it blew out all our internet and everything. And so we had to get we were lucky. We found an electrician locally who was actually working in our development. He replaced the GFI box and he said, please call the cable company. They have to replace the box because it's burnt out. And I'm in the airport on the phone with all these people. Brenda's here doing stuff. So we're trying to go back and forth. So I said, listen, and you're not going to hear from me for 2 hours till I get to Chicago. So as soon as I get into Chicago, and then mercifully, when I got into Chicago, the electrician had done the work, and now she was waiting for the cable people. And 6 o'clock that night, the cable guys came out, and they replaced it with no problem, and she got her internet back. But she said, can you imagine me with no internet for 4 days while you're in Chicago at a convention? I said, no, I can't. So I said, well, you know. But it was just we had a freak storm. Yeah. And when I was driving to the airport down here, like 5 miles out of our development, if the sun's out, there's no rain whatsoever. We were like in a literally a tropical storm, but it was all lightning and thunder and bad lightning strikes. But so that was another eventful start to a sports collectors convention journey for me. Inevitably, either the airplane is canceled or I'm late or not this now. So.
Did you set up at the Natty?
No. I just went in. I got tickets for Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
A mass of humanity. It was just incredible. So Thursday night we had the VFC dinner at Moriarty's, which it was actually literally right across the street from our hotel there that Eric Stang and I were staying at. Then Friday and Saturday all day at the show. Way too much to see, to do, to look at. I only picked up a handful of things. I picked up some upgrades from my run, and then I picked up this 1947 Sportfolio magazine with Choo Choo Justice on the front cover.
Charlie Choo Choo, one of my favorite nicknames.
A big North Carolinian.
Didn't know that.
Big Carolina following. He's a local boy, and I'm very pleased to get it because I've been starting a North Carolina, South Carolina football collection here. So that's going to go into my collection. But one big thing about the National,
blend it into your neighborhood like a doppelganger. You know, you're starting on Carolina football. You know that's that right. Set. Yep.
I started. Going full steam. Just real quick observations. Wall to wall humanity. The flippers were everywhere with their phones trying to beat the comp.
What Pokemon cards did you pick up, Captain?
I did not pick up any. I refused. They were mercifully they put them in a separate section. I know I just said
the group. Yeah.
The one thing that I was really shocked about was that from the junk wax era, I saw many tables that had these 5,000 count boxes of cards that were 25 cents or a dollar. And I'm talking about like 1989 Donruss baseball in these boxes, common cards for $1. And there were guys going through those card boxes and pulling cards out and buying them. And the second thing was the prices on junk wax, which you couldn't give away for $5.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're now, you know, $50 and $60, $70, so on and so forth. I mean, it's just mind boggling to me.
Yeah. Yep.
Totally mind boggling.
Rising tide floats all boats. I mean, I've told you the story about buying, you know, 200 boxes of 88 Topps football from a guy in Seattle.
Once they're $120 a box at the National.
Now they're $120 a box.
I mean, and you know, yeah, you got the Bo Jackson rookie, but does that really drive $120?
Hey, Vinny Testaverde's in there too.
Yeah, and again, what's that? That's $100 card. It's not.
The price of that box is being driven by that 88 Steve Largent card.
Yeah, I keep forgetting about that. You keep reminding me about that. But long story short, I those are my observations.
I thought it seemed
like guys in their 50s and above were the ones still putting the sets together. And the younger kids, you know, they were just trying to buy the one or two cards here and there and the graded cards. And that was it, you know, seriously. And the box breaks were everywhere.
Mm.
It was just pretty amazing to view and watch. I was literally exhausted by like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then checking
walking that floor.
I had walked 7 miles already because we walked down from the hotel. And walking around the show every which way. And obviously not enough chairs anywhere to sit anywhere, you know.
Yeah. So. Was there any friendly tables you were able to, you know, sit down with? Some little oases, I call them. You know, Al Cristofoli or anything, love of the game. On the couch.
I saw Al at Love of the Game, our big advertiser, our inside front cover advertiser. Talked to him briefly on Saturday morning. And Josh Adams, which is now Back to 90s Auctions, was there. I did visit there. I saw Mike Blaisdell and Brian Weisner there and
great
with them. But there was really no places to relax like the old days. The couch was not there of the old MSB BST.
Yeah, I miss those guys. I miss those guys.
So long story short, it was just a long day. And honestly, both days I left at 3. I went back to the room. I rested and then went out for dinner both nights with friends. So anyways, long story short, the hobby's alive. Vintage is hot to a certain degree. One thing that amazes, one really quick story. I'm at a guy's table. He has binders everywhere with everything priced. And he had a 64 Topps card I needed for an upgrade. But it wasn't a true near mint upgrade. It was more X near mint. I liked it, but I didn't like it. And I pulled it out and I asked him, I think he had $6 on the card. I said, would you take $5 for the card? But I, you know, being me, I said, would you take $4 for the card? You know? And then he looks at me and he says, no. And then he turns away from me. And I didn't know the guy was the dealer because he's going through these binders and he's pulling cards out. I thought it was the guy behind him, but the way it was set up, it was a kind of weird setup. So I said, okay. I put the card back in the binder. I put the other binders away, so on and so forth. You go to other tables, you know, I had $20 worth of cards from one guy that I gave him to, and he says, oh, give me 10 bucks for him. And I said, okay, you know, is what it is. You know?
Yeah.
So
he'll haul that 64 Topps, you know, oddball card around to 7 different shows before it gets thrown away.
I'll probably take the $4 for it.
It's I've sat behind tables. I've you know, helped you at the, you know, with at the gridiron table a few times, old, you know, John Spano at BSC a few times. To me, huge difference, you know, sitting behind the table versus, you know, walking the floor.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, it's just, it's interesting to see. And it's interesting. Some guys, some dealers, no problem. You know, if you got the $20 worth of cards.
Yep.
I had one guy, the guy for this magazine, he says, what do you want to give me for it? I said, it's $10. Okay. He's like, yeah, that's fine. Take it. He says, you want any more? Because he had a big box of publications. I said, no.
Nice.
I said, I'm only looking for football stuff. So, but whatever.
That's, I'm only looking for football.
Only looking for football. Hey, there was a big auction at REA.
Oh my, was there ever?
Give us a real quick synopsis of it.
Yeah, I was watching probably, 20, 30 things, bid on about 10. The marquee thing that I didn't even bother with was a 1935 Chickle Bronco Nagurski in a PSA 5. And I sent a photo of it to Vintage Football, VFC.
Yeah.
The right border on that, I don't know if you remember, but the right border on that thing was minuscule.
Yeah.
PSA 5. And my guess was, about 40K. Because if you're looking at that border and you're like, oh, come on. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. Our producer's on vacation, so I can't share it. But we had all kinds of guesses about the price, and it ended at $105,000. That includes the hammer. So
for a PSA 5, unbelievable.
PSA 5 with the skinniest of skinny right border.
Right.
Yeah, really tough. I just rattling around on my noggin is the old adage, by the card, not the flip. Old Joey O, Joe Orlando's old saying, never get cheated. And I'm just looking at this card and it stuns me that more people aren't like, I don't want that in my collection. Yeah, it's interesting,
Right. And again, you mature as a collector and you want something better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep. So I don't know. It's, buy the card, not the flip. And there it is. It is a 16th of an inch. I mean, it's just trimmed, and that's tough. I mean,
we can beat up a dead horse all the time. Why is PSA grading a trimmed card?
Yep.
As five, did they trim it back in 1935? I highly doubt that. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, I forget who we had on as a guest once, but he was talking about being at card shows back in the 80s and early 90s. And he's like, you look at all these. He's like, I never saw PSA 8, card back then. He's like, and now all of a sudden all these cards are being, created.
And I always said that when I was buying my 48 and 49 Leaf cards.
Yeah.
I rarely saw anything that was X or better. Everything was basically VG, VGX, or mostly GVG, and that's it. So that's the issue there.
More lots of other cool things. Some wax, went there. They, but there's a heritage coming up we talked about last time. I also wanted to just say it's always Christmas come early when my Swick Enterprises, innocuous white envelope is in the mailbox. Some really good articles. I really loved the article about how the 49ers got their names.
Yep.
And we've
Martin Jacobs article.
Yep. We've had Martin on before and he's talked about that, but I read that start to finish and I was like, that is fascinating. And I loved the photo he had of the program with the 49er, which I thought was really cool. Nice job also publishing that and getting all those, centered up and stuff. Editor's page, I always enjoy. I like opening that up and reading your editor's page. It's the thought straight from the captain himself. It's like the creation of man, your Michelangelo. From God.
I don't think it's that much. But
yeah.
Appreciate
I speak in hyperbole, you know that. Great, great one. Just a great magazine. Nice job.
We got it. We got a lot of compliments on the USFL article too. That's the league that can't be forgotten.
And yeah,
really, really laid a foundation for the NFL in the late '80s and '90s. But
yep, Super Collector was really good. I love shout out with Josh Rich.
Yeah,
I always enjoy a collector who's into vintage stuff. He's got the Sports King and the and the Chickle the. The Grange and the Thorpe. Yep. So, I mean, that's a man after my own heart in collecting. So well done. And then obviously the shout out to what every collector should have.
That's right.
I'm sure when he sent you that scan, you're like, boy, oh boy.
I almost forwarded you and to let you know that, you know, yet another issue. We have another Largent rookie that you don't have in the magazine. So that's important.
I love it.
All right. Our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him, and we'll get into the heart of our show. Our special guest tonight is an author from Akron, Ohio. He served as sports editor for the Record Publishing Company of Northeast Ohio's news division for many years, covering primarily high school sports. Along the way, he interviewed such Northeast Ohio products as Larry Zonka, Dante Lavalle, and Mike Vrabel. With his family moving to Ohio from Virginia, not fully invested in Cleveland professional sports teams, he became a lifelong Minnesota Vikings fan. He interviewed virtually every former player of the team's golden era for his new book, including Fran Tarkington and the late Jim Marshall, which was possibly his last interview. He also serves as a pastor for a local Baptist church and works part-time with elementary students and the Akron Public School System. And I'd like to welcome today Mr. Rick Bellman. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule for being on the show. And I'm going to lead off immediately by asking if you could tell our audience how you got interested in football and the Minnesota Vikings.
Well, like you mentioned in the introduction, my dad was from Virginia and my mom from Tennessee. They moved up here to, I'm on the, in the shadows of the Hall of Fame. I'm like 20 minutes from Canton.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm right. I passed Canton. I was just in Canton at Thurman Munson Stadium. Memorial Stadium was where the AA Indians used to play.
Yeah.
But so I'm right near Canton. And so I was like, I put in the book, I was a football free agent, a fandom free agent, because my dad.
I really like that.
A fandom free agent, because it wasn't generational, because my dad grew up on a farm. He was in World War II. He came here and worked at Ford Motor Company. So me and my brother just flipped the three channels. We had three different.
Rick, you could have ended up a Browns fan. You got lucky.
I know, we were very fortunate, but in the book we talked about when I was growing up, the Browns were in that post, like they were in that Bill Nelson era with guys like Fair Hooker and players like that.
Fair Hooker.
Yeah, that was one of Milt Morin, the tight end. Leroy Kelly was at the end of his career.
Yeah.
So a lot of us just picked our own teams, and the NFC Central was on all the time because on CBS, they covered the NFC. So every week we saw the black and blue division.
Yeah.
So I fell in love with the purple, the horns on their helmets, the smoke, you know, the coming out of their face masks, you know, the cold. And my brother, unfortunately, fell in love with the St. Louis Football Cardinals.
And oh, wow.
Grew up a huge Charlie Johnson fan, Bobby Joe Conrad, Sonny Randall. So he got the short end of the stick with that one. But basically, we just came into our own, who we fell in love with. And a lot of it had to do with the uniforms.
Yeah.
I can see that, and I believe that. And it's interesting. We had a fellow who on the show who was a big St. Louis Cardinals historian fan. And he says, that's all I study, and that's all I, you know, collect or whatever. And he tweets different Cardinals stuff daily, which is how I found the guy. And it's just really amazing. But so I can see how that, you know, literally that very short period of time they were in St. Louis, there's a lot of dedicated fans to the Cardinals. So
he loved Jackie Smith. I mean, I got to interview Jackie Smith for the book. He was like me and my brother, one of our favorite players.
Yeah.
And they were so good in 1970. They swept the Cowboys. The Cowboys got to the Super Bowl and lost to the Colts in 71. But the Cardinals beat the Cowboys 38-0 on Monday Night Football that year.
Yeah.
And then they also beat them in St. Louis. But they would have these years where they would beat teams like that, but then they lost twice to Tarkenton's Giants in 1970.
And that's
what kept them from – they were at 1.72-1 under Charlie Winter and then they lost like three out of their last four games.
Yeah.
So, but the Vikings was just mainly they were on all the time in from the frozen tundra. Excuse me, Packer fan. frozen tundra metropolitan.
I share the tundra.
Nice. Rick, thanks for being on. First of all, you notice Bob and I are in uniform. We're wearing football shirts. Yeah. What do you got on? Is it Goodyear?
I didn't come. My son-in-law works at Goodyear, so
you didn't get the uniform memo for the show.
We should have told you.
Yeah.
But we do allow free advertising. It's not a big deal. I mean, we're low budget here, so I mean,
how many teams won an NFL championship and moved to a different city the next year? Right.
Next year, yeah.
And that game was decided on a safety called by Sammy Ball, hit the crossbar on a pass. And back then, you were given a safety if the other team hit the crossbar on a pass from the end zone. And that's the winning margin in the Rams-Redskins championship game in 1949.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the 45.
45. Okay, yeah.
This one was a blowout. I just know that because I was asked to do a show on it with Darren Hayes. Yeah. Let's move to your book, Vikings in the Playoffs, the Golden Era under Bud Grant. We had a convenient you have that right there. Talk about product placement. We had a gentleman on a couple months ago who was a Buffalo Bills fan. So I was looking, I'm like, the golden era, Vikings in the playoffs. So I went back and I looked up the Vikings playoff history. And I'm like, man, oh, man, they went four Super Bowls in 7 years, lost all four.
Yep.
If we put you in a room with that Buffalo Bills fan and the two of you started talking about what should have been in the Super Bowl, who would have a better story, you or a Buffalo Bills fan?
I think the Bills were probably more competitive, I would believe, in those Super Bowls. But there's a chapter in the book called I mainly try to keep it positive. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I'm very – somebody that's looked at my book says I'm detail-oriented. And I was never satisfied with the coverage of the team during that era. And I got a ton of books. Every year I'd say, hey, get me a Viking book. And I was never fully satisfied. The best writer they probably had covered him was a man named Klobuchar. His daughter was a senator, I think, Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah. Okay. But
so, and then they had a man, Sid Hartman, who I think just recently died at 100 years old, I believe, that was one of the Viking writers. But I wanted to do something that was, I looked at The Boys of Summer when I was a kid. Remember the Roger Carr book?
Yeah.
And wanted it to be, okay, the Dodgers were always in the series,
yeah,
in the 50s, in the late 40s, and they can never beat the Yankees. They only beat them once in 1955. So I wanted something that kind of lauded the fact that they were always there. And so, Joe, I didn't really talk a ton about the Super Bowls, but I did have a chapter in there that – And Bob read the book and it says what could have gone wrong did. So, but they, to a man, they never felt like they played up to their abilities. The one Super Bowl they probably could have won is the one against Pittsburgh. I think Super Bowl 10.
Right.
They were 2-0 at halftime, believe it or not. But, and they were driving and there was that famous play where Gilliam goes over the middle and gets pole axed by, I think it was Glenn Edwards, and just got spiked. I talk about that in the book, but I think the Bills fans probably, I think they were in their games more than the Vikings were, I'd say, other than the Pittsburgh Super Bowl for the Vikings.
Yeah. It's just tough. Cause I mean, I'm a diehard Seahawk fan. We've been to the Super Bowl three times. We won one. And I know how hard it is to make it to the top and to grab that ring. So I'm glad we got one out of it, you know.
What I wanted to do is hail their accomplishments to get there, because we know from fall football, those championship games are tough to win. I mean, those are
brutal. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I put in the book all the – look, if you look at the Raiders, they lost, I mean, just a host of playoff games. You go all the way back, you know, what, in 68, they lost to the Jets at Shea Stadium. 69, they lost to the Chiefs. I mean, they lost to the Dolphins 1 year. They lost to the Steelers in 72. I mean, so playoff football is tough. So mainly in the book, I concentrated on they won 9 games in the playoffs during that stretch.
Yep.
And really tried to focus on them, what they did to celebrate to get to the Super Bowls. So, I mean, Bud Grant went to 6 Grey Cups and won 4. Now, he didn't have that same success in the NFL, but it just – they were in a time of history where the AFC just had superpowers.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm looking at who you lost to. I mean, you bumped into, you know, Super Bowl VIII. You bumped into the undefeated Dolphins and lost, you know, 24-7. You know, they're, you know, the Dolphins, the 72 Dolphins team, you know, the only perfect season. And they capped it off by, you know, beating the Vikings in a Super Bowl, which is tough.
Well, the year before they beat the Redskins, that the year after that, the 73-74 Dolphins, they beat the Vikings 24-27. But yeah, that 72-73 was the undefeated year.
Yeah.
They still whooped them in 74.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just. You know, I knew the Vikings, the purple people eaters, I knew they were dominant back then. I was just looking at some of these records, 12-2, 11-3, 12-2, 11-2, and a tie. Incredible. I mean, what a run. And,
one of the things, and Bob and I talked about it, was there's a chapter, Joe, called The Lost Years.
Yeah.
Really, it was in 70 and 71 that they could have had their chance, because those 2 years they had a historically prolific defense, and they went from the first game in 1969 at Yankee Stadium against the Giants all the way to a December game in 72 against the Chargers, where I think it was 42 games where they allowed no – straight games where they allowed no more than 2 touchdowns.
Correct.
42 straight games. But Bob and I were talking about in 70 and 71, they rotated quarterbacks. And they would not decide. They had Norm Snead, Bob Lee, and Gary Quazzo. And they were all kind of mediocre. But they wouldn't decide who was going to start till Friday. And so in 70 and 71, so if they get to through in 70, they play an aging Colt team in 71. I think they would have won that game in 71.
Right.
And I contend that the next year, if they would have won in 71, I think they could have beaten just a fledgling Miami team that the Dallas Cowboys routed in the 71-72 season.
Right.
The Dolphins weren't quite ready. Those were the 2 years, if you're a Viking fan, 70 and 71, those were truly lost.
12-2. First place in the East and the NFC, 11-3, first place in the NFC.
Yep. In 70, they lost to the 49ers. John Brody was the MVP that year. The 49ers ended up losing at home at Kezar Stadium to the Cowboys and Dwayne Thomas. 71, the Vikings lost. They were heavy favorites. They lost the first ever Christmas Day playoff game.
Ooh.
In December 25th, 1971, I told Dwayne Thomas, by the way, he's passed away, Dwayne did. He was 77 years old. Dwayne Thomas played 2 years for the Cowboys, and they led him to the Super Bowl each year. But anyway, they lost to the Cowboys December 25th, 1971, and that was the year they could have probably won the Super Bowl. So the 2 years that they could have won were after the 70 and 71 season. Those were truly the lost years. And then they get Tarkenton back from the Giants in 72, and they go 7-7. But they lost 4 games by 3 points or less.
Wow.
Could have won 10-4. And the Packers beat them. Bob.
You know, well, to me, one of the most interesting parts of that book was the quarterback situation. And I truly did not that really refreshed my memory, but I never really put it together that that was such an impediment for them, especially for the offense, because how do you get going not knowing, you know, because each quarterback has his own ways of doing things. Each quarterback has his own rhythm. And to try to pick that up every week.
What was Bud Grant thinking?
What was the
Bob and I were talking about, there's a quote in the book from their general manager, Jim Finks, who was a quarterback himself for the Steelers before he went to Canada. The Vikings have a ton of Canadian connections, by the way, but back then they didn't build around the quarterback. It was if you were drafting fantasy football in the 70s, your first picks would all be running backs. You go through the drafts. I mean, it's meager, the drafting of quarterbacks. Most teams already had three quarterbacks. They didn't need to draft anybody else. Plus, the rosters were so much smaller back then. Mm-hmm. So the Jim Fink says, we don't build our team around a quarterback. So when Joe Capp was let go to become a free agent after the 69-70 season, he said, hey, we're not our team doesn't consist of how well we play a quarterback. But that's the way they did it back then. Every team had a stable of running backs. You look at every team back then.
Yeah.
Look at the Dolphins. They had Morris, Kick, and Zonka. All three of them almost went for 1,000 one year. So they didn't take care of that. They got Tarkenton back in 72. He was older then. One of the chapters in the book I talked to him about that he could not, his last year in the NFL, 1978, he could throw the ball no further than 40 yards.
So
they got Tarkenton back when he was aged. You know, but back then, Joe, they didn't value quarterbacks like, because the passing game changed. When it used to be you can wallop a guy, he was 5 yards, you know,
pull the receiver.
That's what changed. That's when it became a quarterback game, and that changed in the late 70s.
Yeah. Is that what, I mean, going back to, I mean, is that what made you decide to write your book? You know, I mean, going back to Vikings in the playoff, I mean, you're rattling off stats and stuff, and I'm looking over my screen, you know, that I have up of, you know, Vikings, you know, stats. And I'm like, do you have those memorized or are they sitting in front of you? I mean, what was your impetus to write this book?
Well, like I said, those are all in my head. I basically was not satisfied with the quality of coverage, and all the books I read didn't go into the depth. Matter of fact, like I did a whole chapter, guys, on the Hail Mary game, which is 50th anniversary coming up. By the way, my birthday is on December 28th, and I knew I was born to be a football fan because December 28th in 1958, what happened? Colts and Giants.
Greatest game ever played.
In 1975, Vikings, Cowboys, and the Hail Mary game. I was 11 or 12 years old that year. So I was born in 1961. But I wrote it because I wasn't pleased with the details. Like, for instance, no one ever told me what route Drew Pearson actually ran on that play. I interviewed Drew Pearson, and he was a very impressive guy. He was a quarterback in New Jersey after Joe Theismann left. He was a quarterback for his high school team. But Drew Pearson, prior to that drive, December 28th, 1975, did not have a reception. So I dug into that stuff. Yeah, I dug into that stuff. And, you know, like what made the team click? What was the play call? You know, what was the play call when Tarkenton threw a bomb to John Gilliam to help beat the Cowboys in 73? I wanted to know the story behind the story. Like, for instance, there's a ton of stories about how Jim Marshall ended up with the Browns. You'll hear one person say he was unprotected and he went in the expansion. You'll hear other people say he was traded. He was actually traded, and I asked Clinton Jones, he was a great running back for Michigan State, who played on that 1966 game of the century, Notre Dame versus Michigan State.
Right.
And Michigan State had Clint Jones as a great running back. Bubba Smith was a great defensive tackle. Houston, who's number 99 for the Houston Oilers? George Webster, I'm sorry, played for the Houston Oilers. Yeah. Great linebacker. But Clint Jones told me, and this was in the book, that the reason Jim Marshall was not retained by Paul Brown was because he punched out Jim Brown. And I confirmed that with Jim Marshall. And Jim Marshall was not proud of that.
Wow.
But Jim Brown, Jim Marshall lived in Cleveland, close to where Clinton Jones was. He was one of the running backs. And he said that when they were both in Cleveland, because Jim Marshall's first, he played 1 year for the Browns, that they got into a scuffle, and that's what led to Paul Brown shuttling Jim Marshall. That's a story that's never been written. So I told a lot of stories in there. Like, did you guys ever hear of Jack Snow, the running back for, or the wide receiver for the Rams?
Yeah.
He was a, Bob's heard of him. He's a heck of a receiver for the Rams. He played for Notre Dame. Their quarterback was John Hua. Yep. How do you pronounce it? Huardi. And he was drafted by the Vikings, but never played a down for the Vikings because teams would draft players and not do reconnaissance on them. Jack Snow, who was from Southern California, said, I don't want to go to Minnesota.
Right.
So they traded Jack Snow, who became – he was number 84. He's a really good wide receiver for Roman Gabriel. Traded him for Gary Larson, who rounded out the Purple People Eaters. He was the one of the four Purple People Eaters. But Jack Snow never played a down for the Vikings. Drafted in 65. Never played a down. Bobby Bell, here's another story. Bobby Bell, you guys have heard of Bobby Bell, Hall of Fame player.
Of course, Hall of Famer, Chiefs.
A great athlete way before his time. He played for the University of Minnesota because where he was from in the South, he couldn't play college football. So he came up to play for Murray Warmath at University of Minnesota, played with Carl Eller, the great defensive end.
Seahawk Hall of Famer.
Yeah, another Hall of Famer.
The Seahawk Hall of
Famer. That Bobby Bell, a great athlete, was going to just play for the Vikings.
Yeah.
Lamar Hunt woos him, and he goes to the AFL. I talked to Carl Eller, and I said, could you imagine Bobby Bell?
Bobby Bell on that team.
Holy cow.
Locking
Carl Eller said it would have been outlawed if Bobby Bell would have been my wingman as my outside linebacker on that side.
Incredible. Think about that.
But yeah. Those stories are all throughout the book because the reason I wrote it, because I was not pleased with the depth in which they would write. So there's a lot of stuff like there. Like one of the end zones in Met Stadium, Bob, you may remember from the book, was very tight because it was bumped against the third base line that Harmon Killer hit his line drives down. And when you'd see guys catch touchdown passes, they'd be right in the fans' grill.
Right.
And John
right.
Gilliam told me, you know, the field went north to south, and he said, I forget which direction, the field slanted downhill one way. I think it was going south. And he said he liked to run his deep routes going towards where the field slanted downhill.
Yep.
That's so funny.
And a lot of people don't realize, you know, that was the game back then. You know, today everything is beyond perfection. And every play is choreographed perfectly. And every celebration after every play has to be, you know, played out. There was a little spontaneity at that time of the game.
I'll give you an example of that, how everything's perfect now. In 1973, the Vikings, Tarkenton played in his first playoff game, John Gilliam's first playoff game, Chuck Foreman's first playoff game at Met Stadium against the Redskins in 1973, George Allen's Redskins. When you look at the game tape, the Vikings came out defensively in different uniforms. And I put that in the book because I pick up stuff like that.
Yeah.
Things are changed. Some of the Vikings, if you look at the films of that game, had stripes on their shoulders.
Yeah.
Other Vikings had on their mesh jerseys that had no stripes because their equipment manager, Dennis Ryan, told me back then with silk screen shirts, they didn't have the technology to print the sleeve stripes.
Right.
They didn't know how to do that. So if you look at that anomaly, and I asked Dennis Ryan about it. He says, back then, guys would just grab a jersey, and no one cared. Could you imagine today's NFL, the team coming out and mismatched jerseys?
Right.
But that happened in the 1973 Vikings-Redskins game where Alan Page, Jeff Seaman, Roy Winston, and Bob Lertzema all came out with different jerseys.
On purpose, or they just grabbed something different?
They four or five of their defensive starters had different sleeves. They some of the guys had stripes and the other ones didn't. They just
gripped. It's not like they're wearing a home versus away, a white versus purple. It was just different stripes.
Purple, but the sleeves were different. The stripes.
I grew up.
Do you guys remember these? I don't know if you have.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes.
Yep.
These have. A stamp for 22 starters. So I just grew up, and then I talked about my
Rick,
mom.
I can smell that book through the screen. I love it. Just old, yeah. old
that's
paperbacks.
All films record from the 60s.
Wow.
That my mom got me. So I grew up with that stuff, and I just fell in love with all the details. I talked about electric football in the book.
Yeah.
I worry about that. I had a friend. It's beyond Joe's time, but he's a little younger than we are. But it's really interesting. The Redskins, when Vince Lombardi came there, he wanted them to look like the Packers.
Right.
So they went with yellow helmets with a R that kind of puts you in mind of the G on the side of the Packers.
Right.
Right. Yellow helmet with a maroon stripe.
Yeah.
George Allen comes in. And in 72, he gives them their maroon helmets with the Blackfoot Chief Indian on the side, right?
Yeah.
So my friend in his electric football set, he meticulously painted those yellow helmets from 1971 to the maroon helmets in 72.
Yeah.
Could you imagine doing that with a little electric football player?
Yeah.
It was pretty neat, but the Redskins had that helmet from 72, I think, till all the wokeness stuff came in. But that logo was designed after a Blackfoot Indian.
Right.
And George Allen was a great supporter of Native Americans. And they designed that in respect to this great warrior.
Right.
Really an honoring of that Blackfoot tribe.
Right. Right.
One day it'll come back. So.
And that's a story that a lot of people don't know and they don't want to know, but I'm glad you brought
it up. There's a photo that they took that logo from that. Yeah. Anyways. You threw out Carl Eller and I mentioned that he was a Hall of Fame Seahawk player.
Yeah. he went to the Seahawks. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that 1980 football card. And I'm like, Carl Eller, who's that? You know, I flip it over. I'm like, Viking. Oh, there it is.
That was a Bob Patera, Jack Patera.
Acquisition.
The first head coach, but he was it was tough to really put stuff together because none of the Vikings coaches are alive. Everybody's gone. Every one of their coaches, because back then Bud Grant didn't have a huge staff, and everybody's gone. So all their assistant coaches are to their long home, as they say.
Yeah.
The what was interesting when you showed the 72 Sunoco stamp album, I really believe that's one of the most underrated sets of the 70s because it had so many players in it,
totally.
Including the extended series,
which is fine.
I know I only got like one or two type of the extended series, but that is really a nice set. Yeah.
Yeah.
A really nice set to collect and to see, you know, the history of the 70s. That's just a great player mix that
you would go to. I put it in the book. We had a Sunoco station down the street from our house.
Yeah.
And my dad, if you got a fill up, you got a strip of stamps, man. And we would barter over those stamps at school.
Nice.
It was amazing. And now, this isn't the deluxe version,
right?
But this had like stuff about the Super Bowl, the preview.
Right.
There's nothing near like this now. Remotely.
I love hearing you guys pronounce it. Sunoco. I hate to say it. I'm a West Coaster. I've always said Sunoco.
Sunoco.
So I heard Bob say it first. I'm like, oh, okay. Gotcha.
But that's
Sunoco. Sunoco.
But I tried to make it a little bit like at the beginning about the book about the Christmas Story movie is based on In God We Trust, Gene Shepard, All Others Pay Cash.
Yeah.
That movie that you see, the Christmas Story, was based on a chapter from that book.
Yeah.
And I tried to write about what it was like as a kid growing up at this time with electric football and stuff like this. And by the way, who's on the cover of that? You know who that is?
Yeah. Yeah,
John.
Oh, I, I that brought back good memories for me because I'm a couple years older than you, Rick, and I lived all that stuff. I remember it distinctly. I mean, I remember bugging my mother to buy certain cereal because they had cards in it and stuff like that. You know, so I fully understand it. You know?
Waking up early, pouring the cereal into another bowl so you could get the toy out, and then putting the cereal back and watching your brother come downstairs.
And one of my favorite players back on the back of it.
Yeah.
Taylor.
Yeah. He is.
Loved Otis Taylor.
Yeah.
Great, great, great player. But he died recently, I believe. But Gilliam's in Atlanta, and he really had some issues, unfortunately, with Fran. But in the Super Bowl with Pittsburgh, there was a pass he threw that almost got his head taken off. And I talked about that in the book. But as far as getting the book, it's available on Amazon. So it's through McFarland Publishing. And I don't care if I make a penny off the book. I probably won't make any money off it hardly. But I just want Viking fans to have it. I really do. The saddest thing for me, guys, was as soon as I got like publisher copies to send out, one of the first persons I sent it to was Jim Marshall, and he never got the book. And that broke my heart because I love that man. This guy, he was iconic. And I believe Jim Marshall, the Vikings guys, one of the neat things I put in the book, they had no racial discord because the leaders on their team were African-American guys. Jim Marshall was in lockstep with Bud Grant.
Yeah.
So they had no issues with black and white. Now, if you played for the St. Louis Cardinals during that era, nothing but trouble. Dave Megacy wrote a book out of their league, out of my league. And the Vikings, they had great racial harmony. Jim Marshall was really the key point there with that. I mean, Jim Marshall was Bud Grant on the field. What a great guy he was. And I believe, and I'm going to save it, maybe it'll go to the Hall of Fame one day. I think I did the last ever recorded interview with Jim Marshall.
Wow.
And what a guy, what a guy. And I'm a Christian, and I heard he liked the book of Psalms. And I sent him a book on that, the book in the Bible, the book of Psalms. And he called me up, and I kept the voicemail, and he said, "Hey, Rick, thanks for sending me the book." So a lot of interesting stuff about Fran Tarkin. And by the way, Fran, I think, is 85 years old. And so you just wonder how long he has.
Right.
Can I tell one quick Tarkenen story?
Sure.
That's what we're after, is the good stories.
This is amazing. I could write a book about the stories talking to these guys.
Yeah.
You guys remember, ever heard of the book, Legends of Their Time, about the baseball players at the turn of the century, The Glory of Their Times?
Oh, Glory of Their Times.
Yep. Lawrence Ritter,
yep.
A great baseball book. And he went around in the 1960s interviewing players that played in the early 1900s, like Christy Mathewson, Rube Waddell, you know, Henry Hooper, all these great players. This is kind of something I enjoyed doing, talking to these guys. Okay, Fran Tarkenton, his first collegiate drive with the University of Georgia, he inserted himself in the game.
Yeah.
The coach didn't put him in. He ran himself on the field. And you know how, like, when you search stuff on the internet, you'll come up with things you search, like, what is it called? Algorithms?
Yeah.
So his drive, that was Georgia versus Texas, I think, in 1958, I believe, or 57. He was
Did he run out and, like, tell the other quarterback, like, you're out?
He ran out in the field because he did great as a freshman on the freshman team. They didn't let the freshman play back then. So in his sophomore year, he's like the third string quarterback. He ran onto the field, and that's a story he's talked about. He led him on a 95-yard touchdown drive.
Yeah. And the first string quarterback's in the huddle, and he's like, "Ed, you're out."
He just runs out and there.
The other quarterback's like, "Oh, okay."
Get this. So in me talking about Fran.
Oh, crap. That's funny. That's ballsy.
On my YouTube feed, the drive shows up. On the YouTube feed, the 95-yard drive against Texas. It's a rare find. So in the book, I don't know if you remember that, Bob, I did play-by-play that drive.
Right.
And he displayed every characteristic he showed during his football career in that drive. I mean, it was crazy.
Right.
So I called his office up and I said, his secretary's name is Jill. He still goes into work almost every day, Fran does. Yeah. And yeah. I called her up. I said, I have that drive on video. I sent it to them. Okay. I sent it to their office.
Yeah.
And then I call back. And as I'm talking to them, he's in his conference room watching that drive on a big screen television. The first time he's probably seen it since 1958.
Wow.
Wow. I detailed that drive play by play in the book.
Yeah.
Boy, if you check yourself into that huddle and send the first stringer to the sideline, that first play, you'd better do something. Because if you throw an incomplete pass, the coach is like, all right, come on out.
Yeah.
Nice trick, Fran. Yeah.
Well, by the way, he went 95 yards on that drive. The coach took him out after that.
Yeah.
He didn't finish the game. He did not finish the game. Wasn't that crazy? But that's kind of the stories I wanted to tell. And I do people write books not for money. They do it for the love of it.
Right.
And I really want every Viking fan to get it because goodness gracious, we've had so much heartache that they deserve some joy. You know, and so this talks about those because everybody forgets they actually won some playoff games.
Yeah. Right.
Quite a few.
And again, it's an accomplishment in itself to reach four Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Which everybody, like you say, and it's a very valid point. You bring up, saying you wanted to show something positive for the Vikings rather than something negative. And I think, and you did it well, believe me. I mean, it was an eye opener for me. I mean, there was a lot of stuff I had never heard of before. And especially with the quarterback situation, just blew my mind. I mean, that's all I think about when I think about your book. It's how they could have had three different quarterbacks in a season like that where they could have gone all the way, you know?
And I went to the Pro Football Researchers Association convention. It was in Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah.
PFRA. Yeah. I don't know if you guys were. They wanted to build it up. Sabre is the one for baseball. Right. And the PFRA joined that because they really want to build the membership up.
Right.
It's a great organization. They do a conference. And by the way, Broncos Nagurski's granddaughter was there.
Yeah.
He brought of his ring, which I think is 19, size 19.
Right, right.
And the average man wears size, I think, 10.
Yeah.
I mean, she took after Bronco. It was pretty interesting. But I had a guy that was at the conference and he bought the book and he got it for his son because all these guys are being forgotten.
Yeah.
Viking fans need to remember, hey, they had a time where they were actually in contention every year in Super Bowls.
Right, right. We're almost out of time, Rick. Thanks for being on. And again, real quick, they can pick up your book from Amazon. I hope they do.
Let's see that book one more time, Rick.
So,
yeah, Amazon, you could type in Rick Bowman Vikings or Vikings in the playoffs.
Good.
Rick do McFarland Publishing in – and I've been sending it out to the players, and that to me, that's the greatest joy to be able to send it to a player.
Yeah,
and just because a lot of these guys from the 70s are being completely forgotten.
Right,
it's almost like World War II veterans. We only have 1% of our World War II veterans.
One more question: did you ever make it to a Bud Grant garage sale?
I've seen a lot of videos, and man, that was amazing. I being in Ohio, you know what was funny? I've never seen a home Vikings game. I've gone to see him play in Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Cincinnati, Detroit, Cleveland, but no, that yard sale was epic.
That'd be cool.
Well, Rick, thanks for being on. We're squeezing on time. I'm going to hand off to Joe. 2 minute warning, 30 second show. What's your pick on today's show?
Always tip the hat to people who grab something they're passionate about, like a topic like the Vikings in the playoffs, and they write down something, memorialize it for the rest of us. So, Rick, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Sam here. Rick, great job on the book. I did a review on it in this past issue of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And again, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for?
Rick, you're about to receive the coveted Gridiron Great bump in sales.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, gentlemen. Nice to meet you.
Okay, so that's it. We're out of time. And
that always happens.
Back hopefully next week for another show. Joe, thanks for being on. Rick, thanks for being on. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Hey there. Welcome to Music Meets Sports, where sports legends meet custom soundtracks and unforgettable stories come to life through music. I'm Sean, the marketing director. Music Meets Sports was created by music producer Ronald Tyke Oliver to bridge generations, educate fans, and celebrate the greatness of both current and former athletes. We craft original songs about heroes in basketball, football, baseball, boxing, and beyond, highlighting their early struggles and personal battles, their faith, character, and drive, their inspiring victories on and off the field. Across genres, hip-hop, R&B, rock, pop, even country, we reintroduce fans to their favorite athletes in a way they've never heard before. From Babe Ruth to Reggie White, from rising WNBA stars to timeless NFL greats, we give legends their flowers in full surround sound. Stream or download our music now on Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Spotify. Visit musicmeetsports.org to explore the catalog, hear new releases, and join the movement that's preserving sports history, one song at a time. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Music Meets Sports. That's sports with a Z. Music Meets Sports, the raw energy of sports, the emotional depth of music.